you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest today is filmmaker Ramsey Dennison, whose new film, What Happened in Vegas, is an in-depth and searing look at corruption, brutality, and unaccountability within the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Dennison, who had worked production on a number of television shows before making his film, including several programs focused on the heroic work of law enforcement, decided to make the movie after reporting an incident of police brutality he personally witnessed there, only to be assaulted, arrested, and jailed for 3 days for daring to question the prerogatives of Las Vegas cops. While many of us only started thinking about policing in Las Vegas in the wake of last year's mass shooting on the Strip, or perhaps for some of us, 22 years ago when the police there failed and have continued to fail to solve the murder of Tupac Shakur, Dennison demonstrates in What Happened in Vegas a long-standing pattern of illegality, misconduct, and deception by the LVMPD. This award-winning expose examines four particular cases involving the unjustifiable shooting of civilians by Las Vegas cops, the cases of Trayvon Cole, Eric Scott, Stanley Gibson, and Tashi Farmer. With the help of the victims' families and former LVMPD officers, this shocking documentary weaves its way through the maze of lies from top LVMPD officials. But even in the shadow of this deep corruption, we do meet heroic Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department officers who fight to improve relations within the community while keeping the streets safe at the same time. What Happened in Vegas takes an unflinching look at one of the most corrupt police departments in the country and examines the good officers on the force working to bring about change. My conversation with filmmaker Ramsey Dennison after this week's commentary. Well, what a week it has been. Interesting may not be the right word. Frustrating news coming out of Washington. As you know, the last couple of days have seen the government shut down because there was no agreement between Democrats and Republicans concerning whether or not to keep the government open, whether or not there would be protections offered the Dreamers under the DACA program. And ultimately, it appears the Republicans have, in effect, deferred to the wisdom, so-called, of White House senior advisor Stephen Miller, a known racist and Trump sycophant, would-be white nationalist, a longtime friend of, among others, Richard Spencer, probably this nation's most prominent well-known white nationalist. The two of them were friends when they were both at Duke, Miller as an undergrad and Spencer as a graduate student. Miller, of course, has tried to downplay the connection, but it's been there for a very long time. And in many ways, Miller's entire life story up to this point has been one of hardline anti-immigrant and particularly anti-Latinx invective. And so last week when President Trump and Senator Chuck Schumer from New York got together one-on-one to talk about working out a deal that would allow the government to stay open and would offer some protections for the Dreamers under DACA that Donald Trump himself had said he was in favor of, It appeared at first there had been a deal worked out. Donald Trump was tweeting about it in a positive way. Chuck Schumer was speaking about it in a positive way. And then all of a sudden, it was scuttled. And one has to assume, one of two things. Either Donald Trump is so incredibly mentally unstable, in spite of all the wonderful accolades he got from his doctor, that he simply changes his mind, when the clock strikes a new hour. Or somebody got in his ear and said, this isn't good politics. If you cave on DACA, you will anger your base. And I suspect that is what happened. I suspect it's either John Kelly, who is considered to be a relative hardliner on immigration, or more likely Stephen Miller saying, listen, you're going to get farther with your base, the people who love you, the people who come to the rallies, Donald, the people who buy the MAGA gear, Donald, the people who love you and adore you and tweet wonderful things about you, Donald, if you hold fast and don't cave on DACA. You want to please them, don't you? Because keep in mind, every single time Donald Trump has in any way appeared to backtrack, whether it's on the wall or on DACA, ever said anything, even remotely conciliatory, toward brown-skinned folk from south of the border with the United States. The right-wingers have gone into full dudgeon. Ann Coulter has lost her mind on multiple occasions in the last 3 or 4 months. Every single time that Donald Trump seemed to waver in his willingness to do the most horrible of things to brown people, it is seen as a total betrayal. And, you know, as much time as Donald Trump spends on Twitter, that's who he is paying attention to. So the deal gets scuttled and the government gets shut down. As of today, they have apparently worked out a deal to reopen it. And here's what has got me upset now. It's obvious what Donald Trump was doing. He was pandering to the racist, xenophobic, white nationalist base that he knows full well is critical to his political future and his success thus far. The Democrats, unfortunately, being the party that never, ever, ever stands up for their base, right? Never, ever puts principle above what they consider short-term pragmatism. And then ironically, it never ends up actually being that pragmatic. What did they do? Chuck Schumer today announces we have a deal, and that deal involves no guarantee of any protection for the Dreamers whatsoever. You have Mitch McConnell promising that they're going to have a vote on this issue, some comprehensive immigration bill here in the next couple of weeks. That promise is not worth the paper it's written on, because when Mitch McConnell breaks that promise, as he almost assuredly will, what are the Democrats going to do? They're going to do nothing, just like they never do anything, because they don't have the guts to stand up for their base. They're so beholden to trying to chase after white men who work in the coal mines and work in the factories, because they're locked into this 1930s politic. The kind of politic that Bernie Sanders pushes, the kind of politic that a lot of the union guys push, right, which is you got to get these working class white guys who work in the assembly lines and work in the factories and work in the coal mines. They're the future of the party. No, they're not. No, they're not. There comes a point where you have to dance with the ones who brung you and stop playing games with people who hate you, and they hate you precisely because they identify you as the party of those people. Well, at some point, you got to just dance with those people. And you need to mobilize those people. And then if you're able to get elected, which you would be if you would mobilize those people principally, then you can get in power and you can legislate on behalf of all working people, including the working class guys in the mines and the factories. And you can drag them kicking and screaming to universal health care. And you can drag them kicking and screaming to better wages and working conditions. And they'll either get the point or they won't. But this idea of pandering to them, which is what they're doing now, oh my God, because we wouldn't want them to think that we care more about brown people than we do them. Because that's what happened, right? The Republicans start running these advertisements, Donald Trump's re-election campaign, they start running these ads. And what do the ads say? Oh, well, the Democrats will be responsible for every murder committed by an undocumented immigrant because of this government shutdown, because they're willing to castigate and cast away hardworking Americans for the sake of protecting a bunch of quote-unquote illegal immigrants. That was their ad campaign. And rather than call that out for the racist demagoguery that it was, so incredibly racist that you had Republicans on major networks calling it out, saying how terrible it was. So incredibly demagogic that you had poll after poll after poll demonstrating opposition to that rhetoric and demonstrating, by the way, that the majority of the public was ready to blame Donald Trump and or the Republicans in Congress for the government shutdown. And the Democrats still, even though the poll numbers looked good for them, they still caved on the issue. That's what's fascinating, right? Because you're used to Democrats caving when the poll numbers don't look good for them. And at least in that situation, you can understand it, right? Like, at least when the poll numbers don't look good for you, you can sort of understand why you might cave, you know? But in this case, the poll numbers looked good, and they still were like, yeah, we just can't. We can't stick up for brown people. We can't, because we got to get these white guys. These white guys. We can't forget about the white working class. The white working class that hasn't been with Democrats in any real significant way for half a century. Those guys. Yeah, that's not the future of your party. Doesn't mean that their concerns aren't valid. Their concerns are very valid. Their concerns happen to be the very same concerns that black and brown working class folks have. But if those white working class folks don't realize that, all your pandering to them isn't going to make them realize it. You just have to win, take power, and govern on behalf of them, and they'll either figure it out or they will not. If they won't, then to hell with them, honestly. Right? But this is what the Democrats do. So they cave, and now we're going to get the government open for, what, another week and a half, 2 weeks? And then we'll see what happens. Mitch McConnell, always honorable human being that he is, I'm sure he wouldn't have deceived Chuck Schumer into believing that they were going to actually do a vote on this. And Donald Trump has already come out and said the administration's against whatever deal they're working on right now. So it looks as though, you know, this isn't going to go anywhere. So what happened? Who won out of this? Now, I know the argument, right? I know the comeback here is that folks are going to say, well, look, they did at least get a deal on CHIP. That's the medical program, children's health insurance program that allows folks who are not poor enough for Medicaid, but who are unable to afford private care at market rates in their communities to get health care for their children. I get that. They did get a 6-year extension on CHIP, which is great. But you do have to, at some point, you have to ask yourself whether or not there was a way to get that deal and not sacrifice the Dreamers. Or are you simply willing to say, because this is what it seems like, Democrats, and I know it's hard. This part I will grant you. When you are a party that claims to be about working class people and lower income people, and you're on the side of the marginalized, and there are so many marginalized, obviously, you know, it can be a challenge, right? Because when you shut down the government, you realize that you are, in the short term, going to hurt both public sector employees, a disproportionate number of whom are working class, lower middle class, black and brown, women of all colors, Democratic voters. And you're going to potentially shut down important programs that also work to the benefit of such people. And so I get that. I get that, right? That's the catch-22 of having constituents that are marginalized people. It's much easier, isn't it, if you're constituents of the wealthy, because then all you got to do is get tax cuts and tax reform for them, and they're happy, and they give you plenty of campaign money, and you're good to go, right? But at some point, those who are progressive still have to decide, what do they gain with these compromises? Because if you get this extension on CHIP, which they did, but they don't get legit reform that will protect the Dreamers under DACA, you will have sacrificed a very important constituency, a very loyal, I should point out, constituency for the Democratic Party. And in the long run, you will have emboldened the right wing within the Republican Party, which is going in, quite evidently, pretty much all in, as a white nationalist and xenophobic party. When you do that, the question is, have you really done right even by the CHIP program in the long run? You may get a short-term victory, but if you have emboldened this reactionary right-wing part of the Republican Party down the line, have you not, in fact, emboldened the very people who never wanted CHIP, frankly, who want to actually get rid of Medicaid altogether, who would really, in their heart of hearts, love to get rid of Medicare and Social Security and pretty much every other social safety net program? Because if that's the case, then the compromise that you have foisted upon the nation today in order to get a 6-month salvation of folks under CHIP is not going to be worth the paper that it's written on, even for those who in the short run will benefit from it. At some point, you have to throw the gauntlet down and say that we are going to stand on principle, and we're going to stand for what we believe in. Because keep in mind, what poll after poll of Americans finds is that people just don't trust politicians to keep their word. People don't trust you. One thing you can say about the right is they do stand on principle. It might be the wrong principles, but by God, they stand for them. And it's about damn time that Democrats and those who call themselves liberal or progressive or whatever the hell that means start doing the same. Because at this point, it's not looking so good. I'll be back in just a couple of minutes. My conversation with Ramsey Dennison, a filmmaker whose film What Happened in Vegas takes a look at the corruption, the brutality, and the unaccountability of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, whose Unaccountability, for the most part, came into full view for many Americans only with the recent mass shooting back in October, but which has a much longer history than that. I'll be back in just a second to talk to Ramsey Dennison. Stay tuned. So Ramsey, thank you for agreeing to appear on the show and talk a little bit about your film. I just watched it actually just the other day and was really taken by not only the content, which we'll get into in a second, but sort of a little bit your background story as to how you came to this. Because what I found interesting was, although you talk to a lot of folks in the film who are, you know, longtime police accountability activists or attorneys who have taken some of the cases that you focus on in Las Vegas, you yourself, that's not really your background. You didn't come to this. It's not like you set out one day and said, I want to make a film about police misconduct. That's not your background at all. So let's start at the beginning. How did you find yourself in this world of investigating police misconduct, particularly in Las Vegas? Because I think it's an interesting story that folks will be fascinated by.
I wasn't an activist before this happened to me. I was the furthest thing from it. I mean, the truth is I'd gone to Vegas to relax and hang out and just have some fun. And so I just finished editing a really difficult television show. And interestingly, the television show was a true crime show, you know, one of those where the bad guys commit a crime and the good cops come in and solve the problem. So, you know, I came from that background of working on a lot of true crime shows where the cops are the heroes. And I just finished working on one of those and it was really difficult. And so I just kind of went up to Vegas. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I just took the 4-hour drive up there to relax for a couple of days. And there's a friend I knew from the television business who lives in Vegas named Rhett Nielsen. And he's a camera guy that I know. And so we were just kind of hanging out together. And the interesting thing about Rhett was he'd actually worked for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department for years, videotaping SWAT raids. So he had a lot of experience with the LVMPD. And so I was just relaxing, you know, having fun with my friend. And we walked out to a parking lot and we saw four LVMPD officers. And there was a guy in custody bent over the front of the police car. And it looked to me like they were tugging on his cuffs, cutting off his it looked to me like they were cutting off his circulation because he was screaming and flailing around. And they were saying, you know, they're laughing at him and telling him, you know, does your mama know she raised an F up? Does she know that, son? Does your mama know you're an F up?
Right.
And it just really went on and on with these four officers just laughing at this guy. And they didn't seem to be in any hurry to get him in the police car or get him down to the station. They just really seemed to be like taking their time torturing him is what I saw. And, you know, and I just remember looking over at my friend Rhett, who's been on, you know, videotaped hundreds of police situations, and his eyes were just popping out of his head. He's just, this is really wrong. What's going on here? And then the guy's friend came over to one of the cops and said, why are you guys doing this to my friend? And one of the cops started like shoving him. That's when I just said, this is going far enough. I'm going to do something about this. So I pulled out my phone and called 911 to report it. And I just said, you guys got to get a sergeant or a lieutenant down here because you got these officers torturing this guy in the parking lot. And instead of doing what they really should be doing, which is getting him down to the police station and book him, I made that phone call. And then they asked me what I was wearing. And I said, white shirt, khaki pants. And I assumed that they'd ask me that question so that when the sergeant and the lieutenant that I requested come to the scene, that so that they can find me and give my account of what had happened. But instead, it appears that that information got relayed to some of those officers who were torturing that guy because, you know, one of them walked over, an officer named Mark Bellinger came over to me and he said, you know, right after I got off the phone, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I've been watching what you're doing. There's nothing right about what you're doing. So I called 911 and told them about it. And he got furious. He just said, you better get the hell out of here or I'm going to have you arrested. And as I was walking away with my friend Red, I said, arrested for what? And next thing you know, I got three LVMPD officers on top of me. You know, I can barely breathe. One of them takes a boot and slams it on top of my head, which you can see in my mugshot. You know, I just have this big like boot mark on my on the side of my face. So they basically, you know, officers Mark Bellinger, Kyle Frett, and Jared Casper, who'd beaten up this citizen who called 911 to report them, they're going to be in trouble because there's a sergeant and lieutenant on the way. So they did what they had to do, and they spun it around on me. Yeah. And lied and tried to make it look like I was the aggressor, that this television guy from LA just suddenly decided to stir it up with three Las Vegas cops. So, I mean, it was just absurd. I ended up going to Clark County Detention Center for 3 days because these liars lied and said that I was aggressive with them.
You asked also for the video footage, right? Because, I mean, right. Vegas is probably, of all towns in this country, maybe with the exception of Washington, D.C., probably the most videotaped town, maybe even more than D.C.
Oh, gosh.
In America.
Oh,
I mean, yeah. There are cameras everywhere.
Like, in terms of like a 5 mile radius,
yeah,
that Las Vegas Strip, I would be willing to bet, has more video cameras than any place. And there were video cameras all over that parking lot. Yeah, I immediately contacted Internal Affairs. You know, I really thought that this was outrageous and that they would recognize this as outrageous and that they would take corrective action and discipline these officers. But instead, the people I dealt with in Internal Affairs, they were just never anything but rude to me. And they just basically treated me with contempt, like, how dare you come into our town and report our officers. You got what you deserve. That was the subtext, the underlying attitude. And so then when I tried to get a copy of the videotape, when I told them about that, you know, and I said, you guys should need to pull the videotape or whatever. And they were just never of any assistance. So I actually contacted the club directly and was told that, oh, you know what? The video cameras weren't on that night.
Right.
And I told the guy, I said, I don't believe you. And right. they kind of said, well, tough.
So, yeah. So they tell you they don't have the video. And of course, it's crazy because if there had been, I have absolutely no doubt that if someone had robbed the club that night, the club that you were at, and then if the cops had come and the civilian who robbed the club had attacked the officer, I bet they would have had videotape.
I bet you're right. It's like, you know, the videos, it works when it helps them, and the video doesn't work when it doesn't.
So anyway, you have this incident, and this starts to get the juices flowing in your head. Like, there's something going on here.
When I left the Clark County Detention Center, I looked about as bad as I've ever looked. I was filthy. I had a giant boot mark on my face. And, you know, and so I had the arduous task of trying to get a taxi. So after, like, a long time walking around, I finally found a guy who gave me a ride, and I started talking to this guy, and he was a nice guy, and I told him, he asked, you know, of course, what happened to you? And I told him, and he just started shaking his head, and he goes, you know, he says, I believe you. I mean, I've heard the LVMPD do things like this. And he said, what it's going to take is some courageous young reporter who's not afraid to break a story about it in Rolling Stone or something like that, you know? Right. And I said, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to go to the press. And then it occurred to me, it's like, well, wait a minute, I am the press, kind right. of. I mean, I work in television and, you know, I work on documentaries and true crime shows. So I started looking into the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. And that's how my movie, What Happened in Vegas, began, was just with that question of, you know, in a town where you can get beaten, arrested and thrown in jail just for making a phone call to report police brutality, what else has the LVMPD gotten away with? That was the impetus for the film. And what I discovered was this wildly corrupt, wildly out of control department where videotapes go disappearing and lies are told on police reports and cops are seldom held accountable. I mean, the LVMPD is one of the dirtiest, deadliest and most deceptive police departments in America.
Well, it certainly seems that way from watching the film. I mean, not to dismiss the problems that exist in police departments all around the country, but I did find it sort of extraordinary that in such a short period of time, because you had a narrative arc in the film where you focused in particular on three cases and made reference to several others and had some people right. interviewed that were involved in some maybe more minor cases, but you focused on three that were quite recent, that all happened within a pretty short period of time. And what interested me about it too was they did not make the national news in the way that certain other cases have. Cases out of Chicago, certainly the Mike Brown case in Ferguson, the case in Baltimore with Freddie Gray. These were, and I have to think that has something to do too with the way in which the Las Vegas Police Department is maybe better at covering things up than some of their sister departments around the country. So if you could talk a little bit about the three cases. You had Trayvon Cole, you had Eric Scott, and then you have Stanley Gibson in particular, the three main ones. And then Tashi Farmer, really four cases. Talk a little bit about those, because they have a lot of similarities, but they demonstrate a multitude of ways in which the LVMPD operates in a totally unaccountable way. So let's start with Trayvon Cole.
Okay, so Trayvon Cole was this really sweet guy, and he was actually, you know, he was married to a woman named, he was engaged to a woman named Sequoia, and they were getting ready to have a baby. You know, he was working, selling clothes, and so he started selling like really small amounts of marijuana, and marijuana is now legal in Vegas. And so Trayvon Cole was basically selling very small amounts of marijuana, and this police officer, Detective Brian Yant, you know, he was going to be on Cops, on the TV show Cops. And so, you got to give them their big television show. So he found Trayvon Cole, and they did like an undercover filming of Trayvon Cole, like selling very small amounts of marijuana. I mean, I'm talking about like minuscule amounts. So they got it on. And so now Brian Yant, who's going to be on television, going to be on Cops, he's got his big bust, you know? Yeah. And so for this low-level drug dealer, they organized a SWAT raid into his house. I think there was like five or six officers, and they had a no-knock warrant, and they used a different Trayvon Cole that had a criminal history. So they didn't even have – they gave the information to get the warrant for a different Trayvon Cole, and they burst through into his house. And he was flushing a bag of marijuana down the toilet when Brian Yant kicked open the door and shot him in the head.
The two things about that were so stunning. One was the fact that this warrant was made out for the wrong Trayvon Cole. What they had to know, there's no way that was an innocent mistake.
Right. Yeah.
They're writing down a description of the guy. He's not the right age. He's not the right size. So it's clearly deliberate. They know they don't have any legitimate reason to do this raid. They fill out the form incorrectly. Of course, the judge doesn't know that. The judge assumes it's legit, signs off on it. They go in. So that was the first thing, that this raid was completely illegitimate. And the second thing was the way that they staged this, or they were trying to stage it for maximum PR. Because like you said, this was, you know, when they have video footage of him selling this dime bag in the car originally.
Right.
I mean, they could have arrested him away for selling that dime bag.
Got him on the way to going to 7-Eleven.
Right.
It could have been real low key.
Right.
Just, hey, come over here, put handcuffs on him. But no, they had to make television.
The other piece of it that I thought was interesting too was that you noted in the movie that the video production company who was tagging along with the LVMPD, they make contributions to the sheriff's campaign or something.
That's right. And they're not even in Nevada.
Right.
You know, I mean, Langley is like headquartered in California. And so, yeah, they made contributions. And I think it's just absolutely criminal that Brian Yant got away with this and still works in law enforcement, makes it, you know, over $100,000 a year. It's just unbelievable.
Right. And so a few weeks later, then we get, I think it was like 3 weeks later, as I recall, Eric Scott.
Eric Scott, yeah.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about that case, because here's a guy who, very interestingly, he's a white guy. He was a West Point grad. So, you know, even though we know from years of research and information that people of color disproportionately are the ones who get affected by police misconduct, here's a case that shows real clearly that it can happen to just about anybody, and that the police are going to try to cover it up no matter who their victim is. Talk about Eric Scott.
So Eric Scott was this really handsome West Point graduate. He had a master's from Duke. So, you know, upper class white guy. He went into a Costco to get a water bottle for a hike. And, you know, they have open carry in Vegas, which means people are allowed to carry guns. And Eric was carrying a gun when he went into Costco, which he was allowed to do. So Eric went into a Costco, and he was like looking at a water bottle, squatted down on the floor looking at a water bottle, and somebody saw the gun at Costco, and they approached him and just said, "Sir, you're not allowed to have that in here." He's like, "Well, what do you mean? I have a permit for it, and it's legal." And they said, "Doesn't matter. Our policy is that there are no guns in Costco." It wasn't a big deal, but somehow the situation got escalated, and they ended up like evacuating Costco. And Eric Scott, you know, like left the store, and as he was leaving, this guy named William Mosher, Eric, according to many accounts, had a BlackBerry phone in his hand, you know, that looked like a gun. And so when he turned around, William Mosher shot him and killed him. And as Eric Scott was falling, two other LVMPD cops fired more rounds into his back. And then, interestingly enough, like this happened in broad daylight in front of a Costco. Obviously, there's video cameras everywhere, and there were.
Right.
And but yet, as usual with the LVMPD, somehow there was like they said there was a malfunction, and oh, you know what? The video just went. You know, yeah. Sorry, there's no footage because there's no footage of the shooting because you know, and it was even like sent to the FBI and everything, and they recovered like 96% of the data on the hard drive, and it just so happened that the piece that showed Eric Scott being shot and killed, yeah, that was somehow didn't record. You know, it's just a bunch of. They're liars, and it's obvious, and it's so shameless that they can do this and get away with it, and also that citizens let them. I mean, I view the LVMPD as, you know, I mean, they're just really good at forgetting that they work for the citizens. It's the citizens that pay their salary, and just time and time again, they just stomp on the public that pays their salary and lie.
Well, what was interesting about the Eric Scott case, too, a couple things. I mean, there was I don't remember now whether there was an actual trial or it was a hearing or something. But there were witnesses who said, look, and they were crying. They were so upset. There was an elderly woman, not necessarily elderly, but older, who was crying. She said he had his hands up. He never put his hands on his gun. He didn't pose a threat to anyone. He was falling backwards. They continue to shoot him. And then in addition to that, so you've got witnesses who are clearly saying this was an unjustifiable bad shoot. And then. And this thing with the gun is fascinating. So the officers claim, oh yeah, there's a gun at the scene. And yet there is an ambulance report when he gets put into the ambulance where they write down, no, his gun is in his holster. Well, he only had one gun with him that day. He never carried two
they
guns.
They tried to make it that he had two.
Right. So
and because that was their out.
Right.
Know,
so where did that gun, where did that gun
come? They give themselves an out.
Right. So where did that gun come from? Do we think?
That was a good question. I mean, what's interesting is that the public administrator ended up calling for permission to break into Eric's house.
Right.
And Eric Scott's brother denied them permission and they broke in anyway. And then all of a sudden this other gun goes missing. So really interesting how, I mean, they're just shameless. They claim that Eric had two guns because they had to account for the one in the ambulance that was in the holster because that had... The AMR ambulance report had that gun, so somehow this other gun popped up, and they really kind of used that as the justification for killing Eric. And there's just a lot of people today that think that this was a blatant case of lying and corruption, and the conveniently disappearing videotape, which is a common theme with the LVMPD. Right.
And so what ended up happening to Mosher and these other cops that shot Eric? Anything?
Nothing. Yeah. That, as usual, they got away with it. So, yeah, I mean, and, you know, I became really good friends with Eric's dad, Bill Scott, tremendous guy, you know, military background, and they're just great people. And, you know, I really got to know a lot of the victims' families through making this film. And it was sad because, you know, a lot of the victims' families were such good people that I knew that the victims had to also be good people to come from this family. And it really kind of pained me how the LVMPD, you know, they like to kill people twice. They kill people and then they murder their character.
It seems like, you know, it'd be one thing if police officers make an honest mistake and they own it and they take responsibility for it and they implement reforms or whatever else. I feel like the public would be more trusting and they would have the credibility that they need to do the job they're supposed to do. But in every single case, there does seem to be this attempt in these stories that you talk about to demonize those who they've killed. And that brings us then to the Stanley Gibson case. So here's a guy, he's a Gulf War vet. Talk a little bit about his case. Because it was really heartbreaking. You know, you interview his wife.
So Stanley Gibson was a good guy. I mean, he fought for his country. And one of his jobs when he was in the military was to clean up the dead bodies on the field. And because of that, he came in contact with depleted uranium, which Stanley ended up with cancer. And so when he got back, you could see his jaw was deformed. And that was because they had to remove they had to do an operation on his face to get rid of the cancer. So he had kind of a slack jaw and everything. So he had very serious issues, cancer. Sure. And unfortunately, the Veterans Administration, who was never really dealt properly with this, they're a big reason this happened, too. Sure. They cut off his benefits from it was over $1,000 to I think they cut it from over $1,000 to $200 something a month. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, Stanley couldn't even afford, you know, he couldn't even get his medication anymore. And Stanley was very stable and good when he was on his medication. But when he was off of it, just like many people, he wasn't the same person. And so because the VA had mercilessly slashed his medication, they had to move out of the house they were in and into apartments. And so they ended up at these apartment complex. It's one of these places where there's like hundreds of places and they all look the same. And they'd only been there a couple weeks. And so Stan, he doesn't have his medication. He's just trying to get home. He's in his Cadillac and he's driving around and he's trying to get home. And so he knocks on the wrong door.
Right.
And tries to get in, and somebody calls the cops. And as usual, the LVMPD just escalated the situation right away. So they ended up just like, you know, this guy who's trying to get home ends up getting boxed in by police cars. And they had this plan to evacuate him from the car by deploying like a beanbag round. But then they changed the plan. And so the officer who shot him, Jesus Arevalo, claimed that he didn't, because of the faulty walkie-talkies, he heard that beanbag go off and he thought it was Stanley's gun. So he returned fire and killed Stanley.
And Stanley didn't even have a gun, right?
No, Stanley definitely didn't have a gun. So it was like their own gunfire and their own incompetence, you know?
Right.
They fired a beanbag. And again, it was like, and what was really sad about this whole thing, but not a big surprise, is that the sheriff at the time, Doug Gillespie, got up at a press conference and tried to say that Stanley Gibson used his vehicle as a battering ram and officers had to protect themselves. And what Dirty Doug didn't know at the time was that there was a teenage girl with a camera phone who videotaped the whole thing, and then that footage had gotten shown on Fox, and it exposed Doug Gillespie to be a complete liar.
Yeah, his car never moved. Never moved. He was sitting there. His wheels were spinning, I think, at one point, but he couldn't go anywhere. And
he couldn't go anywhere.
Right.
And Dirty Doug Gillespie had gone on all over and done, you know, and tried to make this a justified shooting, and it wasn't, and he was caught. And I think it's a real blessing that this teenage girl actually happened to be there with a camera phone.
And then Arevalo, now the guy who is the shooter, the initial shooter, who actually shoots, what, like seven times, I think, and hits Stanley Gibson several times, kills him. What happens to him?
Jesus did end up getting fired. But here's the thing. He also got put on, like, he got like a medical disability or something. And so he makes like,
Like a disability pension or something that he got a payout on. So he...
Right. Again, they have really strong unions and they protect officers who don't deserve to be protected. It's you know, the deck has gotten stacked.
Yeah, it seems like one of the big problems that you make a great point, I think, of getting across in the film is that there is this element of commerce involved, that there's the corruption piece is so tied to the way that Vegas makes its money. I mean, the LMVPD to some extent, LVMPD seems almost like they function as the hired security force for the tourist commission.
The Las Vegas Convention and Tourism Authority spends over $300 million a year in advertising saying, come to Las Vegas and have a good time. You know, and it's all just makes it look like Vegas is this glamorous paradise where you're going to go to a blackjack table and win thousands of dollars and walk out of the Bellagio with two hot blondes on your arm. And the reality, of course, is that most people come to Vegas and lose money.
Right.
And but they sell that. And so they spend over $300 million a year advertising. And I think there's kind of a tacit understanding with some of the broadcasters who take some of that money that you're not going to do anything that puts us in a negative light.
Right. Well, they're trying to keep the money flowing. And I think what ends up happening is probably the local media and to some extent, as your film makes clear, the police themselves forget that in addition to being a tourist destination where millions of people go and have a good time, they're actually people who live there every day in real neighborhoods, right? People who need protection, people who need safety, people who might work at the casinos, or they might not even have those jobs. They may work in considerably lower wage jobs even than that. And it's almost like that's forgotten. We just think of Vegas as this place where no one lives and everyone visits, but there's actually a lot of people there.
And a lot of those people are scared to call the LVMPD. I've talked to so many people who will not call them.
Well, the point, you know? that point about local and people being afraid to call the police there sort of gets us up to the Tashi Farmer Brown case, because here's a guy who actually approaches an officer for help, you know, and
that's
then
right.
So
talk and ends about, up dead.
Right. Talk about what happens to him. What's his case?
So Tashi was at the Venetian, and Tashi, to give you a little background, he was a guy who he had a clothing design company that he was trying to get off the ground. Good guy. And he was at the Venetian, and he actually approached Officer Kenneth Lopera for help. And he didn't feel safe.
Yeah.
And so he ended up running away. So Tashi has not committed a crime, but LVMPD Officer Kenneth Lopera chases him down, tases him, throws him on the ground, and ends up choking him to death. And then the LVMPD goes to this press conference, and they couldn't really make the video disappear on that one because it happened at the Venetian.
Right, yeah.
And there's video cameras everywhere. And so anyway, so that video surfaced, and you saw the video. I mean, it's just awful.
Yeah.
You watch Kenneth LoPera just choke this man to death who's committed no crime. And so the second in command of the LVMPD, Kevin McMahill, went up to the podium and he acknowledged that Tashi Farmer had committed no crime. He says that
right
off the bat. And then he proceeds to trash his character and try to kill Tashi twice by bringing up his criminal history and talks about something that happened over 20 years ago. And what's interesting is he's trying to and he's doing that so that the public will write Tashi off as a scumbag and let the LVMPD off the hook for killing him. And I mean, what is more evil than dirtying up the dead, than killing somebody unnecessarily and then killing their character? And I looked into Kevin McMahill's background, the officer who trashed Tashi, and found that early in his career, he was part of a squad that found a woman with drugs on her and told her they'd let her off if she showed them her vagina. And the case went to court. There was a payout, and McMahill left the LVMPD after that. But then they let him back, and he rose all the way up in the department, and he's currently number two, the undersheriff, the second in command.
Yeah.
I mean, with people like Kevin McMahill in charge, it's no wonder this department is a mess.
Well, what's interesting about that, too, is, I mean, I think it is important to point out, and I think it was a good additional narrative arc of your film that, you know, this is not, because you know how people, when you know, in this society, when we criticize law enforcement, there is this assumption, totally unfair assumption, that, oh, you just hate cops and you just, you know, you have this entirely bad view of police. But the reality is you have a second narrative arc in this film where you talk very seriously to folks in Las Vegas within the police department who are very clear about the problem, who know there is a problem, who are fighting for real reform and real change, and being rebuffed at every turn, and at this point have been unable to crack that system. So, for instance, you talk about the sheriff's election back in 2014, a guy named Larry Burns who runs for sheriff, and here's a guy who's got a long history of incredible work in one of the highest crime parts of Las Vegas, but he's gained the respect of the locals. He's gained the respect of the community. Talk a little bit about Larry and about that race, because I do want people to know that there are folks out there fighting for change that we need to be getting behind and pushing in not only places like Vegas, but in other parts of the country. So talk about that.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I'm not a cop hater. I really am not. I mean, I think the problem isn't that most cops are bad. The problem is the ones who are get away with it, particularly in Las Vegas. But one of the really good cops that I met making my movie What Happened in Vegas is Larry Burns. And he really kind of turned my view around. And he was a guy, he was in charge of the SWAT team for many years. And then he was the captain at Bolden Area Command, where he brought crime down for the first time in over 40 years. He did it kind of unconventionally. He said, no saturation teams in my neighborhood. Get those people out of there, you know. We're going to actually form a bond with the community. And Larry walked around his precinct and got to know the shop owners. And he just talked with them and said, what is it that you want from us? And how can I help you achieve that?
Right.
And so he took this community-oriented policing approach, and it worked. And crime went down in Bolden for the first time in 40 years. And he was a great cop. I mean, universally, probably one of the most respected cops in the history of Las Vegas. But he ended up running for sheriffs, and because a lot of the LVMPD cops wanted him. I mean, the police union took a poll, and 96% out of the LVMPD officers, 96 people out of 100 wanted Larry Burns to be sheriff. And the other guy he was running against, Joe Lombardo, it was a guy that nobody wanted, but he had the backing of the casinos. And so he raised over $1.5 million compared to Larry's, I think Larry raised around 860 something. So Larry had less than half the money Lombardo had, and ended up 49-51, which we talk about in my movie, What Happened in Vegas. We explore this sheriff's election and the results of it. And after that, a lot of the LVMPD cops retired because they didn't want to work for this administration that was dirty, that they don't respect. And, you know, interestingly, Vegas just had the most deadly year on record. There were more homicides in Vegas in 2017 than ever before.
Right. At a time and, when homicides dropping in other big cities, when the nationwide crime rate is actually going down. And now they get Joe Lombardo. He wins that election in 2014. Here we are. He's, I guess they have 4-year terms. So he's coming near the end of his term and things are getting worse.
My hope is that, somebody, you know, and so hopefully, you know, I mean, I hope the movie raises awareness of the problem to the extent that they can get this guy out of here. He's done nothing right. He, you know, the crime rate's been flying up. I mean, I don't even know what his campaign slogan would be. Vote for Joe Lombardo because he has money.
What's fascinating about that election is, you know that things are bad and that things are corrupt when the police union is so uniformly behind the reformer. Because to be perfectly honest, you know, my experience,
not your friend.
The police unions are the ones who will defend every act of brutality, every act of misconduct, every act of corruption. And so if you've got a police union that's like, yeah, screw that, we want change. You know your guy is screwed up. I mean, you know, and like you said, even the police union, the film talks about how the police union had protected and taken care of some of the bad cops that we've already been talking about. But even they realized, look, we got to have someone like Larry, as opposed to someone like Joe Lombardo. And unfortunately, like you said, money talks and the rest of it walks, I guess, in Vegas, which brings us up to, you know, and I really, you start off the film and you end the film in a familiar place, I would say, for a lot of viewers. And that is really the first time that most of us who haven't spent a lot of time in Vegas or any time in Vegas really came to think about the Las Vegas Police Department. I mean, for me, the first time was back when they failed, still 20 years on, to solve Tupac Shakur's murder. That's a whole nother issue.
I think that was about commerce as well.
I think it was, too.
because think about it. And you know, I actually know a woman named Kathy Scott who wrote a tremendous book about this. Yeah. About and she's a best-selling author, and she's written a lot of interesting, but she basically, if that had gone to trial, what do you have? I mean, you've got you know, thousands of articles are going to be written about it over the course of this trial, you know, and it's about murder in Vegas and Vegas being a dangerous place. And what does that do? It kills tourism. So,
well, then not just dangerous, but like if one of the most, if one of the most famous artists on the planet can be murdered in your town, right on the strip, right? And especially like if they had solved it within 12 hours, they might not have minded because that would have looked good, right? But the longer it drags on, I mean, if they solve that thing now, that's nothing but bad PR for them. So no question about it, which, you know, for me, that was the first time I ever thought about the Las Vegas police. I personally have only been in Vegas one time in my life and haven't had any interactions with them. But for most of us in the country, probably the October 1st mass shooting, Stephen Paddock. And you start there and you go back to that because there's a lot of weirdness around the way that the Las Vegas police interact with and work with the casinos to protect people like Stephen Paddock, who are high rollers, not just your average, you know, mom and pop that go in to, you know, spend $30 at the casino, but the guys like Paddock who spend millions of dollars over several years. Talk a little bit about some of the, before we talk about Paddock in particular, talk about what you learned or what you now know about the way the Las Vegas police bend over backwards to protect the casinos.
Well, really interestingly, the associate producer of our movie, Stephen Stubbs, he'd actually done some work for the shooter's brother. Stephen Paddock's brother, Eric Paddock, the associate producer of our film, had actually interacted with directly. And through this, he'd corresponded with the LVMPD and the FBI. And what he learned, Stephen Stubbs concluded that, you know, this back line had been called based on the information he had, that one of the problems was that when Jesus Campos was shot, they called a back line
rather than 911. In other words,
rather than just calling 911, because it you don't call 911 on high rollers in Vegas. And think about why that might be. It's because, you know, as soon as you call 911, all of a sudden it's on scanners. A journalist can pick it up, write a story on it, and all of a sudden this high roller, you know, ends up in the newspaper for doing something unsavory.
Right.
And so they protect high rollers And, you know, and so they called this back line, and that is one of the reasons it took so long to stop Stephen Paddock, is because they protected this high roller. And this is something that goes on in Vegas. And you certainly never heard Joe Lombardo say anything about that in any of his many press conferences. The Vegas media is intimidated by the LVMPD. It's because, you know, I know a former reporter at the Las Vegas Review-Journal who told me that Sheriff Lombardo twice came in and tried to get him fired after he wrote an article about how the crime rate was rising. Wow. And interestingly, he had his press credentials revoked after that, and he no longer works for the Las Vegas Review-Journal.
Right.
And so this is, I mean, that's pretty unsavory, in my opinion, when the LVMPD treats journalists like that. I mean, what is this, third century China? What does Joe Lombardo think he is, an emperor?
You know, what's stunning, obviously, when something like what happened, this tragic, horrible mass shooting takes place, I mean, nothing could be worse from a PR perspective for Vegas. So there's no doubt that I would imagine the casinos, you know, will take a hit from that. The city will take a hit. It's certainly going to change the way that they plan these outdoor, you know, music events. So I guess the last question I have for you is where from here do you think that police accountability activists in a place like Vegas and really, you know, anywhere else in the country where these problems exist need to go? You feature some good activists in the film who've been trying to do some really great work out there. And of course, oftentimes end up being, you know, again, brutalized by the police for doing it, whether it's chalking the sidewalk or whether it's filming, you know, misconduct. Where do you think that needs to go? And I know you're not an activist by background, but still, you've no doubt gained some insight. So what should people be pushing for now, whether it's in Vegas or anywhere else?
Yeah, I think the people who enable this need to look themselves in the mirror. And I'm talking about the governors, the DAs, all these people who look the other way. And let this kind of stuff, I mean, to me, they're culpable in this. The district attorneys in Vegas, the politicians, and I think we need to start reminding the police that they work for us. And I think these police unions, I don't have any much good to say about police unions.
Yeah.
I mean, when Kenneth Lopera killed Tashi Farmer after he not committed a crime, the president of the police union in Vegas, Steve Gramas, actually started a GoFundMe and raised over $40,000 for this guy.
Right.
Who just killed somebody who hadn't committed a crime. And so I think the Steve Gramases of the world are part of the problem. That just this idea that like cops are always right all the time. And I mean, that's a bunch of trash.
Well, I think you're definitely right about that. And I think in addition to all of those things you mentioned, folks need to definitely check out your film and spread the word about it. What's the best way that folks can see it and stay in touch with you and your future endeavors as a filmmaker?
Well, the best way to see What Happened in Vegas is to go to www.whathappenedinvegasthemovie.com, where you can see it on video on demand, DVD, Blu-ray. And then we also have a Facebook page.
And then the Facebook page is also under that title. So if they search under that, they'll find
What Happened in Vegas. Yeah, if you look that up, you'll be able to follow the film.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Ramsey, for coming on the show. And I hope everybody will check out the film, What Happened in Vegas.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Gene Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song Gather Round as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.